your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, a.k.a. Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Power Athlete Nation, today we welcome Les Spellman, one of America's elite speed performance coaches and founder of Spellman Performance, former walk-on at Temple, and he's trained several Olympians as well as athletes in the NFL, NCAA, USA Rugby, and guided a large number of youth athletes to college scholarships. Welcome to Power Athlete Radio, Les.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, man, I'm excited. I had the opportunity to scan some of your interviews, and one of our coaches, Darren Hansen, he connected us, so he gave me a little bit of your background, and I'm excited to share it, man. So I want to kick off with your journey into coaching, and that started way back when you were an athlete and then led to eventually a walk-on at Temple University's track team.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I wouldn't call myself much of an athlete in the way that I see these guys and how athletic they are now. Like, I was very mediocre as an athlete growing up. Never really stood out. I was always like average, middle of the pack, had okay athleticism, never was really skilled enough on the technical side for any sport. And then like tactically, I always struggled because I always grew up playing like pickup, you know, like I played 21. I didn't play 5-on-5. Or like I played pickup soccer, pickup football. Like I wasn't into structured sports. Like I would much rather go ride my bike or go do other stuff. As a kid, I like just free play. So when I get into high school, I'm just like super average. Like I was on JV as a junior in high school. That gives you context. Like I wasn't that great of an athlete, you know? And I was also at one of the best sports schools in the country, but still it was like very average. But my senior year comes and I'm like, you know what? Like, I don't know if the sports thing is for me. Like all my friends are getting scholarships. So I'm like still trying to make the, you know, get off the bench on each team at my high school. And I'm just like, maybe I wasn't really built to be a Division I athlete. So long story short, I take a left turn instead of a right turn. And I start working on, you know, hanging out. Like I'm out there hanging out with my boys. I'm living in DC. So you walk outside and there, you know, you could run into some trouble pretty quickly. And that's what happened. And I really just decided like, yo, I'm not going to play sports anymore. I'm just going to hang out and do this. So long story short, it gets to be April of my senior year, like second half of the year. And I'm like, dude, I'm just going to college. Like, I'm already committed to University of Virginia, just to go there, just for, you know, education. And I get in this really, really, really bad car accident where I break my femur. And essentially what happened was, you know, I got airlifted to the hospital. They're like, Les, you know, your leg is fractured in half. You've touched an artery, and we got to do emergency surgery. It wasn't that calm. Like, I'm saying it calm, but I'm assuming the doctor came in and said that to me. So next day, I wake up after surgery, and I have a rod, you know, where my bone marrow used to be in my femur. So from hip to knee, and they screwed it in. They're like, Les, look, like, hate to tell you, but, you know, you're not going to run again. Like, you will be able to walk. You'll have a normal life. You'll have to keep a cane with you. You'll do physical therapy. You'll be in pain your whole life. And it was that sparked it for me. And it was like, look, like, first thing, I just wanted to, like, bang on that doctor, because he basically came in and gave me my fate. And I'm like, you're not in control. So at first it was like this adverse reaction, like, I'm going to prove everyone wrong. So I'm working. I'm reading Lance Armstrong. I know it's probably taboo at this point, but I think this is 2007. You know, Lance Armstrong was the guy. Like, we have strong bands. All that stuff was popular. So I'm reading his autobiography, and I'm like, all right, this dude had testicular cancer, got back on the bike and started rolling. So I'm like, okay, if he can do that, it's just a broken leg. I can fix this thing. So, you know, I start working. My mom goes to school. She's a teacher. She leaves for school, leaves for work, and I get up. I just practice, like, trying to stand up, trying to walk, trying to take myself to the bathroom. So long story short, you know, I basically took small wins from going to the bathroom myself, to showering myself, to walking to the door, to walking to the end of the house, to walking to outside, walking around the block. Like, got to the point where now I'm walking 2 blocks, 5 blocks, 10 blocks. And I'm like, yo, like, I got to run. Like, I can figure this thing out. So I completely dedicated myself to becoming an athlete again. And within a year, I was walking. And within 18 months, I was running. And as soon as I ran that first time, I was hooked. And I was like, look, if I can go from wheelchair to walking to running, obviously the next course of action is go to the Olympics, right? I'm thinking there's, like, not that big of a gap. Like, I already did the hard work. So I'm like, I'm gonna figure out a way to get in the Olympics. And I start training for speed. And I'm like, I'm going to walk on Division I track team at Temple University, and I'm going to be a superstar. Like, that's how I played it in my mind. Not really how it happened. Like, I get to the point where I get a tryout, and essentially I only got a tryout because I went to the coach's office so many times within a 2-week period that he was annoyed and goes, Les, you could just come try out with the cross country team. And if you can hang with these guys for 4 miles, I'll let you be on the team. I'll let you come to practice the next day. And I did that. And somehow he just kept coming. He told me, hey, come back the next day. And by Thanksgiving time that year, the roster came out for the team, and I was on the team. But, like, it never was like, hey, last like you made the team. It was like, I kind of just glanced at the website before Thanksgiving break and saw my name on the roster. So it was a very interesting journey. And I never really became that good at track, to be honest. Like, and I'll tell that, you know, later on. But for me, it was huge going from not walking to being a Division I athlete. You know, that was huge.
Yeah, it is a hell of a journey, man, and an opportunity to many young athletes out there that they can play collegiate sports. Many write themselves off, and you have the opportunity to really prove to yourself and many others out there, whether you knew it or not at the time, that there's so much opportunity to level up your athleticism.
So with the injury, was it completely healed? Do you still have any issues with it? I mean, so a femur break, was it a compound femur, shattered? You know, were there plates in there? Yeah. Or like, what was the extent of the injury?
Yeah, it was compound fracture. And actually the way that it did is, like, it broke where it split in half. And then the bottom part of the femur was actually raised, like, it was higher than the top part of the femur. So it was like cross pattern. And in the process, it ripped a lot of muscle tissue. So when they put the pole down the middle, it basically, you know, it held those bones together, and then the screws kind of sealed it in there. So the first, like, year, I was in constant pain every night. I was, you know, terrible, terrible pain. I got addicted to painkillers within the first couple weeks. You know, I was on a morphine drip for the first 2 weeks in ICU, and then I come home with, you know, prescription pills. My mom throws them away, and I was going through withdrawals. So pain was, like, huge. I mean, it was tons of pain. First 6 months was really bad. Second 6 months was getting better. 18 months in, almost no pain. Like, there was definitely weakness, and there's definitely, you know, like, instabilities. So there's pain, like, my groin would flare up because I just didn't have the groin strength anymore. Or I didn't have, like, you know, there's the hamstring strength. Like, there were so many things around the hip that I started to, you know, feel weaker in. But as far as, like, the structure, there wasn't much pain. And when I really started strength training, that's when the pain started going away. It's like the rehab, I mean, I don't want to criticize my rehab, but it didn't work for me. But strength training was my rehab. When I got stronger, that's when I started I didn't have pain and I got faster.
Well, the usually with the rehab process, the idea is that they're trying to rehab the injury back to a point where, like, as an average person, you can go live your life. So I think that's where, like, right. A lot of misconceptions, people think like, oh, I'm going to rehab this and it's going to get me back to how I was. That's not the case. I mean, unless you're, you know, a professional athlete that's, you know, a team has vested money to try to get you back on the field. I mean, the rehab stuff, my older brother tore his patellar tendon and he had to go to rehab. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their big thing was just like, okay, we're going to get function back, and like a full range of motion for them was like, okay, you're healthy now, full range of motion. And like, he calls me and he's like, hey, I got all these issues. I'm like, well, you know, here's some programming. This is what we got to do. You got to get you back to this. And thank God we had some friends that helped him back. But I just think that the model, and then the other issue you run into is most physical therapists, and we know this because we have a lot of physical therapists that follow our methodology and also within our Power Athlete network, lifting weights is not part of their curriculum, and most of them don't know how. So then you're like, you know, you're like, hey, I want to come back as an athlete. I broke my leg. And they're like, well, you have full range of motion. Pain is gone. Get the fuck out of here. Insurance is over. Right. And then it's like, now I got to go back 100%. To the gym and get fucking strong as fuck. But then how do you do that?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I had an occupational therapist, like, to give you context. Like, this guy would come by my house and he'd be like, Les, like, I'm going to help you stand up. I'm going to help you wipe your ass. I'm going to help you, you know, get water from the fridge on your own. I'm like, bro, like, I'm trying to go to the Olympics, bro. Like, what do you mean? Like, wipe my ass. Like, so, and then I go to PT. PT's like, all right, we're going to get you to 90 degrees flexion. I was like, is that the goal? Or is that like this week? And they're like, no, that's the goal. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go. I'm gonna slide out left and start working on this on my own.
Did you have like, I mean, obviously the break in the femur, but was the lack of range of motion in the knee or the hip, or a combination of the both?
It was both, but the knee flexion was an issue initially because I actually couldn't bend my knee at all after the surgery. So really, I mean, they drilled screw and they did a lot of traction from like the actually below my knee and above my knee to get the bone set in place. Mm-hmm. And they drilled holes in like my VMO. They drilled holes in my quad. They drilled holes in my calf. And like, I had a ton of issues just because of that.
So shit, dude, let me get some context on this. So what they did is they put fucking anchors in, and then they drilled all these different, for those of you guys that are listening, you can do the visual. What they effectively did is they put in anchors and then they used traction so that they could try to get the bone to line back up. Cause a compound fracture means that it actually sets this way, spiral break. And then there's different versions of that. Like when I broke my fibula, it was compound. So it was side by side. But what they'll do is they'll stretch and they create traction and they have to find anchor points, you know, and if you know levers, they put like different lever points. And so then it creates that, and then they're trying to get it to heal in. And then you were probably immobilized while this was happening. So then your leg is 100%. Locked in a fixed position at zero. And then you come out and your knee, which hasn't been bent for how long, were you in the traction device?
I mean, it was weeks on the traction device, but then when I had the, you know, left actually out of the surgery, like I was immobilized for, I mean, I don't even know how, I couldn't even tell.
Probably like 3 months. Like, cause so.
Yeah, about 3 months.
When I tore my patellar, same thing. They fucking locked me in a brace, and like, I couldn't bend my, you know, I was like in bed for 3 weeks and I couldn't bend my knee for 3 months. And then they get out and they're like, okay, time to rehab. And you're like, fuck, I got no quad, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I used to get, I don't know if this happened to you, but I used to get, when they locked my leg, I would get these, like, the only thing I could call it was like phantom contractions.
Spasms.
Like I would just start, like my leg was straight and I would just start firing my quad and trying to get it to fire. And it just happened randomly all day. Like I'd be sound asleep and wake up and my leg would be firing. It's the weirdest thing. And they're 100%. Like, oh, it's a phantom contraction. I'm like, there's nothing phantom about this. Like, what's fucking, my body's ready to go. And like, this shit's fucked up. I mean, so yeah, dude, I've been there. Yeah. I mean, not as severe as that one. I mean, mine was, you know, a patellar tendon, but fuck, dude. So they have, so anchor points pull you apart. They put a steel rod in to try to fuse the bones and then put plates and screws and everything to fit it together. Damn.
Yeah, no, it was serious. Like, it was, and like, when I explained it, like, hey, like, we're going to do this surgery, it was more like, we're rushing you into surgery at the moment, and we're going to start the traction, and you're going to be going, like, out of it as we're doing the traction piece. Like, we're going to, you know what I mean? It was like, holy crap. Like, I could see them bringing the equipment in the room, you know? So yeah, it was rough, but it left me to the point where, like, I had atrophied so much, and I was probably 145 pounds when I got out of that, like, phase, maybe 145.
And you mentioned you were headed to UVA. Did you put that on hold because due to this injury?
I actually ended up going. So the other piece of the injury that I had was I actually had a traumatic brain injury from the accident. So I was, like, really struggling to read and comprehend, and just like attention, you know what I mean? I'm sure some of that was just PTSD and all that stuff, but there was like a rehab process for my brain. And part of that process helped me become a coach. Like, I learned how to, like, group things. So, like, they would give me all these words and be like, group all these words into a box and then name that box and then put a bigger box and name that box. Like, I was doing things like that as rehab. So I went to UVA my first semester, but I was struggling. So I dropped out. I went back to community college, and in community college is when I started really diving in. So, like, think about just the timeline. So that was April is when I had the surgery. By September, I was already at school, but I was barely moving around. So, like, think about going to class, think about all that stuff. It was a challenge, and I was on my own. Like, family wasn't there. So it really wasn't until, like, almost the next April that I was, like, out of pain. And then that's when I was in community college. In community college, I was able to, like, really hone in on my personal rehab process. And that year, that's when I pretty much propelled myself to get to the point where I could run and run fast.
And for your strength training, like, where did you go for a resource? Did you lean on just, hey, this feels right at this moment? Or did you have a coach or a program to go after to help you in the gym?
Yeah, like, initially I was really poor because I didn't lift weights in high school like that. You know, like, I graduated high school in 2007. So our strength coaches were typically like a football, like, D-line coach, or it was like a gym teacher. You know, it wasn't anybody that was qualified, I should say. It was kind of like, all right, here's three lifts, roll through 3x10. So, like, I started out and I was, like, so weak, I couldn't do that stuff. So I actually focused on body weight first, just like push-ups, pull-ups, and squats. And those are the three movements that I really just did in a high volume initially, and then I added lunges because I was more advanced. And then I added, like, basic things like, you know, just like single leg squats, and I just grew. I had no idea. But when I got to Temple and we had our strength conditioning stuff, like, that's when I really, really grew. Like, I mean, that's when I started really loading. So I would say that the strength period I had was really general basic strength stuff. You know, push-ups, pull-ups, you know, jumping jacks, like, calisthenics. Like, I didn't know any better, you know, but it was super helpful.
Well, no, I mean, if you look at all the base level GPP training stuff, it was always calisthenics. I mean, shit, Jim Wendler still has his guys do jumping jacks is to build basic, you know, I mean, you know, air squats, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, jumping jacks. I mean, like, that stuff and that base level GPP stuff is so important, especially when you come back from an injury. I think everybody thinks, like, you know, the more advanced, the better, but sometimes you just need to get a base level of fitness and just start moving. Which I don't know if people, like, pay that enough respect, where you're like, all right, yeah, like, there's a bunch of different training modalities that we can get into, but, like, are you coordinated basically enough to do jumping jacks or do skips?
Right.
One of my favorite things, and we've seen this at seminars over the years, and I see it all the time, especially when I was doing some training yesterday, just watching adults try to skip is fucking hysterical. we were trying to just basically just do, like, alternate arm skips. Like, follow the leader stuff, and the amount of people that were, like, same leg, same arm, and couldn't do it, I was like, holy shit, dude, every little kid in the world can skip. Obviously, you take some like 20, 30, 40 year olds and ask them to skip, it ain't really going to happen very well. So, I mean, there's some base level coordination and just being able to execute those things that is so important.
Where'd you go to high school in DC?
St. John's.
St. John's.
So it's like a big sports school.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
Yeah, I coached at St. Albans, so for a little bit.
Oh no way! My brother went there.
What year?
He's 4 years older than me.
Oh, he's older.
So he graduated 2003.
Yeah, I definitely missed him then. Yeah, I was coaching there 14, 15, 16. But yeah, well versed in the DC area. Yeah, you probably know my cousin. He went there, but we'll talk offline about that little bit.
Yeah.
But awesome, dude. I want to continue down this road. So you took your own approach to learning how to move, and I want to eventually get to where you are now. So essentially, from bodyweight calisthenics into the weight room, when did you start to incorporate the speed drills? So it went from basic movements to now, hell, you're leaving the ground. You're getting explosive.
Yeah.
So what was that like emotionally and physically?
It was hard. I mean, I remember the first day at Temple, we get in the weight room and the coach is like, all right, like start off at 135, you do a couple of reps and then build into like your work sets. And I was maxing out at 135. No lie. Like, I mean, it's embarrassing to talk about now, but that was as much as I could do. So I was so far behind strength wise that like I had to start working with the coach kind of on the side, which ended up being a blessing because, you know, he taught me how to lift. He taught me how to get stronger. Like I really dedicated myself to the weight room. So that was the first part. And the second part was like, we started doing speed drills and track and field. Obviously like your warm-ups for like an hour and track. Like the first day I was like, all right, man, that was a good workout. Coach was like, all right, now get on the line and we'll run. And, you know, I had done, you know, 16, 18 drills, you know, before that. So I really understood from that point that the patterning of learning how to run wasn't necessarily going to come from just running. Like there had to be another thing. Like obviously I knew I had to be strong enough to run, which I can talk about just like in terms of how I'd look at it and assessing speed. But the first thing that I wanted to do was look at speed as a skill. And if I could understand the postures and if I could understand the patterns that were associated with those postures and then understand how to apply power to it, then I could run faster. So I just started to apply that framework. Like I knew the gym was going to give me the power. I knew the drills were going to give me the technical skill application. And then I would apply it in my run. So if I had 16 runs that day, I had 16 opportunities to practice what I just kind of built within that triangle.
Awesome. Who was the strength coach you were working with at Temple?
Mark Proto. I think he's at the College of Charleston now, but yeah, that's my guy. Yeah, he was amazing.
No, there's, I mean, dude, it's pretty conclusive. I mean, from not only working with athletes, but all the research that people that sprint are generally stronger than the people that don't. The eccentric nature of sprinting and being able to pull through, like anytime, you know, we're training athletes, like if we can put some form of sprinting in, even if it's like something, you know, uphill sprint or something resisted, I mean, it doesn't have to go real long, but I know for athletes, like you can get strong lifting weights, but the minute you start putting that sprint component in, like the strength numbers go through the roof. And I think it's severely unutilized, especially in the world of the internet where everybody's trying to get strong and they think it all happens. And I'm like, dude, even if you had like, you know, 4 to 7 max effort sprints once or twice a week, you know, maybe every 72 hours, like in a smart strength conditioning program, you know, where you're maybe training 4 days a week and, you know, building a little bit of zone two. I mean, fuck, dude, like we've seen it just over the years. It's such a powerful stimulus that
100%,
you know, it just makes sense. And then you're talking about technique and efficiency and like, you know, being able to run is like, you know, I mean, dude, one of the classic ones, it's really easy to assess athleticism, especially when you watch people run, or like I was talking about watching people skip. I mean, just being able to be fluid with the nature and being able to move through it, like it's really just like an instant snapshot to the point where, you know, Cal Dietz, you know, he said, dude, I can see somebody sprint 10 yards and tell you exactly where they're deficient and whether or not, you know, what degree of athleticism and if in kind of his hierarchy they sit and what they need to do for their training.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built our online training business by partnering with Train Heroic and helping us deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training.
And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best tech and training, Go to trainheroic.co/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
For sure. Yeah. Well, if you look at like sprinting you could put it in the weight room. Like it's just another exercise classification. Yeah. It just happens to be the highest velocity thing that you can do. There's not an exercise in the weight room that you could do that's over 5 meters per second, 6 meters per second, or let's say even just 15 miles per hour, whatever you look at it. So it's a stimulus that will aid in power, because power can come from, it can come from the strength side, it can come from the velocity side, but with a good balance of the two, like you develop your ability to develop force-based power, which is going to help your acceleration. It's going to help the beginning part of the run, but developing that speed side, the velocity side, like you got the only way you can really do it is get out and do it.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to replicate that. You have to have prerequisites of power in the weight room and, you know, ability to apply force. But one thing that's really interesting is that the way you apply force in the weight room is significantly different than the way you apply force in the track. And if you look at it, it's like we're applying forces within 0.2 milliseconds. Like we're applying in 0.2 seconds. Like you have to apply a huge amount of force in a small time frame. And the way that you do that is not just like slow grinding strength. It's your ability to whip your leg down to the ground, which is highly technical. So having a balance of all those things helps you apply forces to the ground to go forward.
Well, I mean, the other one is you have to have a certain amount of rigidity. And I mean, I don't know if it's rigidity or stiffness in the tendons and the ligaments.
Yeah.
You know, I use the word rigidity, but yes, it's really stiffness. And it's extremely hard to develop that stiffness with closed chain barbell lifts. You know, you think about like plyometrics or jumping or sprinting. I mean, that ability to be able to like absorb and reduce and, fucking generate force to be able to sprint is extremely hard to do in the weight room. That's why, like, at some point you got to, you know, and we, you know, when you look at it, like, because people are going to listen to this podcast and be like, oh shit, I'm going to go out and start sprinting. And I'm always like, whoa. there's like a very real, like acclimation phase. And we use it with like lifting weights and plyos and short runs, getting people up, because I don't think that they realize what a potent stimulus it is and how easy it is to hurt yourself. I mean, the amount of people I've seen and we taught at seminars, like the minute they came out, all of a sudden the horizon changed, where all of a sudden their heads come up and all of a sudden as they arch and they start reaching and they blow a hamstring. And I'm like, fuck dude, I've seen that too many times. And it's because they just don't have, within the tissue, the ligaments, I mean, the stiffness within that, I mean, all these key factors, like there has to be a preparation phase to get somebody to sprinting. Cause I think we think about it like, shit, I sprinted when I was a little kid, I ran all the time. It's so natural. It's one of our, you know, like most primal basic patterns on the, but yet if you don't do it with regularity, it can be extremely dangerous.
Well, it's just like, I wouldn't walk in the gym and put 600 on the bar if I hadn't squatted in 6 years, 7 years, 10 years. Like, I wouldn't jump into a max strength phase. And it's like the same thing for running, is it's progressive. Like you can only, you know, if you think about maximal sprinting as the goal, like getting to maximal sprinting could take weeks for someone to actually get there. But what can you do? You can accelerate. So like multiple accelerations are relatively low velocity and it's more muscular based. And if you're like training and your thing isn't sprinting, it's not sports, and you want to train speed, I would train acceleration. I would do heavy sleds. I would push sleds, pull sleds, those types of things. Like getting to the velocity side, it has to be progressive. And each week you can add a little bit more to the point where you're going out and you're actually full sprinting, but you've microdosed velocity exposures into your training where, you know, you might start off with 5 yard sprints. That's high velocity if you haven't sprinted in a while. Or then you start doing 10-yard sprints, and then eventually you do 20 or 30, but you progress. Even when we have pro guys come, like, I don't care if you've been sprinting your whole life. We take 2 weeks to really rebuild our exposure to velocity before we actually get into high-velocity stuff.
You know, that was one of the points of contention we had when we heard Joe DeFranco speak years ago. You remember when he was talking about training those combine guys with heavy sleds? He was using basically heavy sleds to like replicate everything. The only issue is there's no eccentric load when you're pushing a heavy sled. And that was like always a weird one for me, where I'm like, hey, he's using these guys to kind of prime them, but yet there's no eccentric load with a sled. So like when you move them over, like how are you progressing into it? And we never got to answer that question. But then again, he didn't claim to know any science. He just knew that for some reason, when the guys push sleds, they sprinted faster.
But yeah, like, I could talk to that.
You know, but that's that's an interesting piece. Like, I think that people, when they think about the idea of like putting their foot in the ground to sprint, don't understand that like the eccentric load is so much more powerful because you're effectively almost carrying through and then putting your foot in the ground and like driving it through, and like the, you know, like the ability to transition between concentric and eccentric is such a important phase, but we know the eccentric is so much more damaging.
Yeah, Les, I'm gonna tee you up here. So part of that presentation, Joe was focusing on what he did with his professional athletes, and we got no context on what he would do with a high schooler. And you pride yourself in that development and have the opportunity to really work with some NFL athletes. So help us bridge that gap in the importance of what you utilize, whether it's just, hey, I do these assessments with my pro athletes to make sure they're in check, or, okay, here's our long-term plan to get up to that full speed that John's speaking of.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the same. Like, it doesn't change, I think, the way that you approach it and the aggressiveness you attack it with, or the length of the system. Like, you know, how you train high school athletes in the weight room and how you train them, you know, NFL guys, is like, it is relatively the same components. They're just at different ends of complexity. So first thing you look at is like, are you effective as a sprinter? Like, can you run? So if you look at time and velocity, you look at a 40, you look at a 20, you look at a 30, whatever it is, like, are they effective? And then from there, you want to answer some questions like, where are they not effective? So if I look at sprinting and I look at a 40, really what it is an acceleration. That means they're going from no velocity to the highest velocity they can reach. Most people, high school, pros, everybody, they have a phase of that acceleration where they're not good. So let's say it's early. Okay, that means they're not a good starter. Or if it's mid, they're not a good transition. Or velocity, they're not hitting a high velocity. There's something that's going on. Very few people can do all three very well. So the next thing I want to do is I want to give exposure to each of those phases. So let's call the early part, like the early part of acceleration, let's call that force-based power. So that's an athlete's ability to concentrically produce force and be able to move their body to a higher velocity. Now, like you said, there's not a ton of eccentric forces in there or eccentric contractions, but the ability to concentrically produce force, if you can, if you're strong, if you can trap bar deadlift, if you can squat, you can be good in a 3-yard, 5-yard sprint. Like, that's, there's a requirement there to be strong. Now, if you look at the next phase, I'll pick some of that transition. That's really power, because it's a mixture of being able to produce forces and climb to higher velocities. So the contact times are getting faster and getting more elastic, but it's in that middle. I'm still climbing. And then at velocity, we know that that's like very elastic, but I need to have all three to be effective, right? So what happens is when people are training speed, they typically focus on one of those three things. So you go to track practice, it's very high velocity. We're just going to go run, and we're going to run very fast, very, right? Or if you go to football practice, you might pull sleds, you might push sleds, you might do stuff in the weight room that's very, very, very force-based, but you may not get that velocity exposure. So a good program really, really takes all three into account. So if I want to train the early part of my run, you know, I'm going to get stronger, going to be in the weight room, but I'm also going to push and pull heavy things. Now, if I want to be good in my transition, and I want to be effective climbing to higher velocities, I need to have a mixture. I need to have like a medium load if I'm running with a load, maybe some hills, higher velocity exposures, more jumping, more broad jumping, triple jumping, all those types of things. Now, if I want to be good at the velocity part, I need to do elastic things. I need to work speed, strength in the weight room. I need to work plyometrics in short ground contacts, right? I need to work on depth drop and those types of things to fill that bucket. So for me, the first thing I look at is, can I fill the physical bucket? And if I'm doing it in the weight room already, what are some ways I can apply those things faster on the field and more horizontally oriented to get that more specific stimulus for that athlete? So I want to be as close as I can to the actual, you know, actual skill set, right? So if I'm working acceleration, I want every drill to work the skill set of acceleration. And then I just build it from there. So if I'm working a total season, it makes sense to work some of that really heavy acceleration stuff like off season. Like, I'm building strength at the same time. Now, as I'm getting closer to season, I'm gonna do more power. And as I get closer, I'm doing more velocity. It's very similar to how you would systemize your weight room work. And it can be concurrent. And the best way to do it is do them together. So either your strength leads your speed, or your speed leads your strength. either way, you got to make sure that you're staying within your buckets. You're not going to train a max strength and heavy, long, you know, pulling and all that stuff, and then go out and do high velocity work on the same day. You want to match those qualities up together, and that's step one.
And for a training session, how long does it usually last? Let's stick with the high schoolers. Is that a 2-hour session? You got them for 90, you got them for 60. Like, what's the focus there to accomplish all of this?
That's the thing, is like, it could be any time, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45. So if I have a short amount of time, then I'm going to go after the exposure. So if I don't have a lot of time, the number one thing I want to do is make sure I get my speed exposure. So that's either accelerated speed, or that's high velocity running, or it's jumps and plyos. And I want to get the physical work. The more time that I have, the more I can bleed in coaching. So coaching is a stimulus. Coaching is difficult. Coaching is an adjustment. But I want to make sure that I only am doing that when I have the time to make corrections, talk through things, work through things. If I don't have time, the number one thing I can do is just get exposure. So what most high schools see it as is like, all right, look, like, I don't have time to do an hour session, so we're just not going to do it. Well, You could go out and do 3 fly runs. You could do 5 accelerations, 10 accelerations. You could do a ton of accelerations. You could do high volumes, but you can do low volumes of speed that microdose throughout your weekly schedule. But what I see is that people are like, if it's not the highest level complex, we don't have time. So to answer the question, in the off season, I would spend more time. I would spend time coaching. I would spend an hour if I can. As I get closer to the season, I would do more stimulus. I would pull back on the coaching. I wouldn't coach as much. There's so many things these guys are learning technically and tactically in their sport. If they're a football player, they got to learn plays. They got to learn. They got to study film. Don't make speed something that competes with that demand. So do your coaching in the off season. And as you get closer, now we're just looking for stimulus. And what we do with schools, we work with 2 NCAA teams, work with the NFL team, we work with the hockey team, work with different teams. What we do is we help them get exposures in practice. Because if you're doing it at a high level and doing it the right way, you've built the right off season, that you have your phases of force, speed, power, and velocity. As you get to the season, you design your practices to touch on those speed qualities and get those speed exposures, where you can have, hey, we're going to do higher velocity today with longer rest periods and certain drills and certain periods, so you guys can be exposed to high velocities. And we've seen it show up in games. So at that point, it's really just about, like, every week making sure we tick the box and getting above 90% velocity. And we know if we do that, the game is going to show up. We're going to hit velocities above 90, maybe even 95. To give you an example, we have a Pac-12 team that has 37 new top speeds in season this year, 37 different numbers. So it can work in season as well.
So how are you tracking all this? I mean, is it, I'm just wondering on, like, the technology aspect.
Yeah. Like, I mean, GPS is become a commodity. It's so easy to get GPS now. So with the Pac-12 teams, they all wear GPS in games. And it's really easy. So essentially all that data goes into the cloud. I get that data out of the cloud. I make the report. I can see everybody. But in high school, like, let's say there is no budget, you can't track those things.
Yeah.
You can gauge efforts. So I know that, like, athletes know what 100% or 95% effort feels like. And you can ask them, like, was that full effort? Like, it could be more subjective, but if the intention is there, like, hey, today we're going to give you an opportunity to reach above a 90% effort. Guys know what that means. Like, you can feel it. Or if the practice is just kind of like tempo based and you're just kind of going through the motions, and like, that's important too, to get volumes in. But if I want to get intensities, it's going to look a little different. I need to have some intention to explain to the players how to do that.
Yeah. We used to use, when I was training with Roth, we used to use the banded resisted runs to coach technique, because it wasn't until, like, all of a sudden when cell phones started getting really dope video with, like, iPhone, like, we started shooting video. So then all of a sudden we could coach in real time. So then all of a sudden now you're getting coached off the video, like, hey, look at one arm, the swing. Whereas, you know, before when we were running, people would be like, great job, you know, and you run away from them. So we started doing banded resisted runs so that we could actually walk and get coached at the same time. And then when we got actually to shoot video and brought some stuff out, it was huge. I mean, now I think about it, like, shit, the technology is so dope that, like, you know, a kid could have an iPhone, shoot it, and then send it over to you somewhere else around the world. You could look at it and probably give them real-time feedback.
100%.
That would have, I'm not kidding you. Like when I think about like how many days within like the training space of learning to Olympic lift, if they could have just shown me what I was doing and then coached me off of that, how much faster we could, opposed to just like, you know, screaming cues at us. And so I 100%. Think like, you know, the ability to coach speed and see this stuff and replicate, or be able like, hold on, I have an athlete that's really good. Let me show you what he's doing. And then seeing like the one-to-one instead of like, you know, in that real time thing, man, like the coaching space is so much easier. Like I was thinking about our athletes, like we're working with, like shooting video of them being like, hey, you're doing this. I need you to do this. And then them being able to make that correction is so invaluable.
100%. And the interesting thing is on that is like, so we have a Pac-12 team, we have an ACC team. Those are two different conferences, two different time zones, two different worlds, right?
Two different offenses, two different styles of football.
Two different styles of football. Yeah. Now, let me tell you this. We've done zero technique with them. And each team is having, on average, 4 to 5 new top speeds per game. So what does that tell me as a coach? It tells me technique is important in certain phases. But is that the most important thing in season? Probably not. Am I going to make a change? Probably not. But what is the most important thing is exposure and stimulus. So like you don't have to have a high training age or coaching ability to actually make someone faster. All you really need to do initially is get them exposure to those things. And then you can start to shape it up into the technical piece when you have that opportunity. But what I see now is in the industry, there's less and less people that feel comfortable that are like, oh, you know, well, speed is great, but like, I can't coach it. Like, yeah, you can. You can design practice.
Yeah.
If your head coach could be your speed coach. Hey, let's decide that we're going to do speed in practice today, full speed.
Well, I think that there's a bit of a misconception. I mean, with like, you think about strength training, like, you know, can you, like, I always think about strength training a little bit. Like, am I going to listen to somebody who's not strong? Like, that was something I ran into a lot playing, you know, playing football. You know, you're in the NFL and like all of a sudden, you know, you're getting coached by a dude that never played in the NFL and might never have played offensive line. And that was always kind of weird for me. Like I always took coaching better from dudes that are like, hey man, when I, you know, was playing next to Anthony Munoz, this is how we locked it down. And you're like, well, shit, that dude's pretty good. He's in the Hall of Fame and I know who this guy is. Like that was always more meaningful. You know, same with strength training, like having a coach that actually was fairly strong or, you know, a sprint coach that actually could run. So I wonder sometimes like, and you know, we were talking a little bit about like sport coaches that might not be physically fit enough to be able to do their stuff, you know, having the same credibility piece. So like taking sprint coaching from somebody that can't run, like, does that pay? I mean, is that doable in today's world or, you know, does that not pay dividends?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a misconception on what speed training is. Like speed training is not technical, just technical training. Like if you want to do technical training, there's a lot you can learn from track and there's a lot you can do. Not every coach is going to be Dan Pfaff and Steve McMillan and Jonas. Like those are amazing. The world's best eyes in coaching. Like no one has a better eye than those guys. But you can make someone faster without having a ton of knowledge how to make them faster. If you can manage schedules, if you can manage stimulus, if you can manage exposure, then you can do it. So it's not like, oh, I'm a sprint coach. Like, no, I'm actually a football coach and I might be your DB coach or wide receiver coach. I can make everybody in my group faster just by exposing them to top speeds and then managing the rest periods and managing how much volume they do.
Yeah.
So if there's like, take the risk away, there's a risk in doing a lot of volume of high speed running.
Well, yeah,
so you have to understand that part.
Because it's super hard on the central nervous system. And I think people, what they do is they try to replace quality with fucking quantity and they figure we'll just hammer it home.
This is the sport coach challenge for many. And unless you're doing a great job educating the sport coaches in which you're working with and showing where speed and the different exposures can fit into a practice. But then there's a lot of coaches out there that say, we're not in good enough shape. So they expose to too much volume that's slow, cyclical, monotonous, and we're getting in fourth quarter shape that then can take away from, unfortunately, the speed of these guys, which will, I mean, if you're that far ahead in the game, what's fourth quarter shape?
Yeah.
100%. Well, most of the time, what I've seen is that it's not that they're out of shape, is that they can't repeatedly run high speeds, high power events.
Yeah. Yes.
They can't do repeated high efforts. They're in shape. When I look at, a couple of times, like I'm like a complete nerd with this stuff. Like I don't really watch TV, so I just go do stuff. So I put GPS on a high school team, 10,000 yards in a practice. Now, if you don't understand what that means, if you're listening, I also track NFL teams. One player hit 5,000 yards. Another player hit 6,000 yards. Nobody's over 7,000 yards in an NFL game. So you're right. Telling me that a high school team is doing 10,000 yards of practice. Now, when I look at the speeds, there's about 80% of it less than 50% velocity. Yeah.
Well, if you look at your off season, and I'm sure you're looking at these percentages based off of off season. If a dude comes in and runs, let's say 11-second 100, what's the percentage? And when you look at an NFL deal, nobody runs fucking at 100%. If you're trying to run in pads, you're trying to shake a DB. Yeah. If you're a receiver, you're trying to run your route. At best, those guys got to be 80-85%.
No, actually, every single skill player that we have that plays division in ACC and Pac-12 will hit above 90% in game. They average if we have things correct. It wasn't always like that. 85% was kind of the standard, but now players are playing above 90% and they'll have exposures to one or two runs above 95 or to 100. Now we're seeing new max speeds weekly. And I'm saying new max speed is including the summer when they're running in shirt and regular shirt, shorts. Those are flying, and it's because they're being exposed. Speed training, they can get faster in season all year. You can progressively get people faster the entire year. So players are our NFL guys that play skill positions that allow them to run will hit above 90% velocity. Obviously, if you're a running back and don't break, or you're running inside routes, or you're covering the slot, you may not hit it. But guys that have – most of the guys will hit it above 90%, and especially even in practice. And if you look at how you practice, you can work on getting in shape. That could be a day. If you look at soccer, they have tactical periodization where one day of the week there's volume. There's 120% of the game volume. Then the next day might be 120% of the power events, which means times that they accelerate, times that they try to hit top speed, maximal efforts. Then you have another day that might be maximal decelerations and changes of directions, but they have themes. And if you touch on those qualities, you can make your practice, your physical training in season, and make it actually make you better throughout the season.
I'm liking all this. I'm tracking on all of it. So I get the opportunity to coach at a local high school here and was approaching our, because they a lot don't use the weight room or have any formal training. What they are exposed to at our practices is it. So I get 14 minutes of practice. I was just thinking directionally. So front to back, sprinting forwards, decelerating, and eventually working in back pedal. And then lateral movement. So teaching them different crossover steps, 5-10-5 progression, and just looking at it in terms of directional. But now I can incorporate the different, the start, the acceleration, and the max velocity, the phases that you're speaking on here. So I can see that play into our practice. I was just thinking directionally, but now the intensity and the volume balance that you're speaking of.
I had a coach years ago who told me nobody ever got accidentally fast. He's like, I'd seen people get accidentally strong where they just would do something and get stronger in the weight room. They strength happened by accident sometimes. You would get strong in spite of what you were doing. He said nobody ever got fast accidentally. If you wanted to get fast, you had to run fast and put effort forth. And I always thought that was a pretty interesting one where nobody, you see somebody run fast. They just there has to be something I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's people that rolled out of the womb, put their foot in the ground and fucking went 100 miles an hour. But, and there's freaks in the NFL. We played with dudes that were fast, but very few people accidentally got fast. I never just happened to be fast. It was always a lot of effort, a lot of work, controlling volume, knowing that it's extremely hard in the CNS and that, just fucking junk volume. That was the whole, Charlie Francis deal. You're either running 92 plus or you're doing tempo runs anywhere in the no man's land. It's just going to be fucking junk volume. It's going to hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah. And even it's so crazy because what coaches don't understand is speed isn't always the same for every position. So speed for a defensive lineman is going to be a lot different than the speed for a receiver by requirement. So a defensive lineman is going to have to maximally accelerate and have to make an impact and continue to accelerate and change directions, right? But the actual maximal velocity is not really there. So if you actually, they are going to end up in those 80% range, but it's because they're only taking six steps, seven steps. But that's like Aiden Hutchinson. He spent a lot of time developing like his ability to maximally accelerate from his position, right? But then you look at like big skill guys, linebackers. Now they're going to move more lateral side to side and make change of direction and be able to accelerate two, three times in a single play. But then you look at a receiver, they might only accelerate hard one time in a play, but they're going to hit a higher velocity. So there's three different types of strains. Like the high velocity part is going to be extremely taxing on the nervous system for that receiver. But then there's going to be physical, like muscular demands on the lineman and some of those like deceleration, reacceleration, those types of things. So the stresses end up looking slightly different in the exposures. So like five, if you take five reps and if I say, we're going to look at practice and manage reps. If I take five reps from DBs, five reps, receivers, five reps, linemen, five reps, linebackers, those five reps are going to be very different if I were to dive deeper in what those five reps look like. So that's why I think positionally, and this is, you could take this out of football and put it in basketball, forwards, guards, small forwards, all that stuff. Like there's different demands within a volume. So if I just looked only at volume, 5,000 yards, it's not enough. If I looked only at intensity, which is high speed, it's not enough. If I look at all those things plus excels, how many reps or time between reps, like all those things matter. So it's really interesting when you break down, like, what can you actually improve? You can really improve what you train, like you were saying. But what happens is a general blanket stimulus gets covered for everybody because it's, hey, we don't have time. But then you go practice football. Well, you do have time because you can blow the whistle and take a minute or 45 seconds, or you can take 10 seconds. Those are two energy systems you're working. You know what I mean? So there is opportunity. I think it's just coaches need to understand what speed looks like. And it's not a sprinter running 100 meters. Last story I'll tell is we have a high school that is the most unathletic high school in San Diego. It was, right? So we came in there. I'm not going to say the name, but, you know, the kids are smart. And they won't feel it any type of way of me saying this. Kids are really, really smart. But they lost 20 games in a row. Like, no lie, 20 games in a row. Zero games 2020. They won one game in 2021 at the end of the season because they played like a division lower. So we came in there and all we did was all season we ran through, went from force based power to velocity. During practices, we started giving them opportunities to have higher speeds. So anyway, the team is, you know, they're in the second round of playoffs tonight. They lost two games, 7-2. There's opportunity. There's opportunity there. And you can do it. It's not hard and doesn't take an expert to do it.
Awesome. Yeah, we love success stories. And I want to take back a step back to your athletic career. Following Temple, you had the opportunity to play a little rugby. And my question is, man, how was your brain thinking at that moment to take your track skills and start to apply them to this multi-directional reactional sport?
Was it rugby or was it sevens?
I played sevens. I played 15s and sevens. Yeah. Okay. Played 15s and sevens.
It was the sevens for sprinters is fucking the coolest game. I don't know. Like, to me, like, I like the 15s, but the sevens is dope because it's like watching 7-on-7 and those guys get on the outside and can just fucking run, which is pretty amazing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was an opportunity. For me, it was a challenge. Like, all right, I'm asked, like, for me, everything was related back to my journey. Like, okay, I got to the point where I could run straight. But I couldn't change directions. I couldn't decelerate. I hadn't tackled anybody. And I was like, let me just throw myself in an uncomfortable situation here. And I was sick and tired of like running left every day because that's all you do in track. You just wake up and you run left, right? Every day. I mean, we're in Philly. It's cold as hell. And I'm like watching the rugby team go to practice. They came on the field after us. And these dudes are like drinking beers on the way to practice. I was like, oh, that looks like fun. And then they're like smacking each other and then they're going to eat after. And I was like, this is the exact opposite of what I just dealt with. That was a very military program that I was in. It was like hard work, blah, blah, blah. Great coach. Still, he's going to be at my wedding, all that stuff. But it was hard. And I wanted just to have fun my senior year. So I was like, let me go out for rugby. And I go out there and they're like, all right, let's like hang out in the wing. We'll get you the ball and just score. And that's all. I didn't know the game at all. I just got the ball and I would just go score. And had an opportunity to come to San Diego. And, you know, they were bringing crossover athletes in to join the Olympic program. And, you know, I happened to get a chance to be in that group. I wasn't very good, like, looking back. Like, I was athletic, but I was very low skilled in the actual sport. Like, the sport can take fast people, but you have to have skill, and I didn't have skill. But yeah, it was an amazing opportunity. I love rugby for sure.
No, I mean, there's some fast dudes. Like, I just looked it up. There's like a dude for the All Blacks that runs 10.6. There's another dude, 10.7. They said there's another, I mean, there's this guy, Christian Wade, is running 11.2 meters per second. I mean, dude, these guys are flying.
Carlin Isles.
Yep.
He ran 25.7. He was my first athlete that I coached in the Olympic program.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They just showed 25. Him. Yeah, they said he's got 12.4 meters per second, setting the 100-meter world record. Or no, I'm sorry, they're comparing to Usain Bolt, but he ran 11.5 meters per second or 25.7 miles per hour, dude. That's smoking.
Yeah, he's in my stable, so he's one of the athletes we coach. And Perry Baker can run 24 miles per hour. Like, on our rugby team when we were like 2016, 17, we had 7 guys that could reach 23 miles per hour. 7, like, that's unbelievable. Like, you can't find an NFL team with 7 dudes that can run 23. I promise you, there's maybe 4 per team, 3 per team in an NFL setting. So yeah, unbelievable speed in that sport for sure.
Yeah, no, it's really I think the cool thing about rugby is you know, these dudes were such hard hitting individuals, and then all of a sudden, like, you see like these speedsters and these faster dudes who've kind of specialty players fucking come out and they just smoke it. It's great to see. I love it. I think it's such a fun sport. Yeah. I grew up in Southern California and was not exposed. And I did play for the Eagles. So I lived in Philly, lived in Rittenhouse, and lived in Manayunk and all that. So, I really wish when I went to Cal to go play football, you know, Cal rugby, you know, national champs every year. And we had guys that were, you know, good on our team and went out and were rugby stars. And I was always like, man, I wish I had been exposed to this sport at a younger age. I would have loved to have played.
Yeah. Yeah, Jack Clark is the man. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cal is like unbelievable.
Yeah,
I mean, those dudes are like the toughest athletes that I've coached. I mean, hockey is probably up there too. I just haven't been around hockey enough, but it reminds me of how hockey players' mentalities are for sure.
No, well, Cal is such a legacy for it. Where, like, you know, now you have generational, where it's like, you know, guys that I played with and now their kids are playing. And so you'll have like 2 or 3 generations of guys who are like Cal rugby players. And it's so cool to see the culture. And then, you know, it's still like watching the NFL now, like, I'll see a name flash up and I'll be like, Oh, that's his kid. Damn, I feel old. So, it's kind of neat to see, but I mean, I really think like rugby is such a neat sport in terms of like athleticism and power. And, you know, for so long, American football's just dominated, but I'd love to see more rugby on TV if I could.
For sure.
Nice.
I mean, it's a growing sport, but not the fastest growing sport in the country.
Is lacrosse the fastest sport in the country?
Uh-huh. And Les has had the opportunity to connect with the Premier Lacrosse League for some developmental speed training for their youth, man. So I did want to take the time to highlight what you're doing with the PLL youth.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Let me ask you a question before I answer that. Is it also the fastest sport in America, like, speed-wise? Because, like, if you think about how fast the ball is moving, is there a sport? Is it faster than baseball, like throwing, like pitching?
Can we really call baseball a sport?
Organized grab ass.
Yeah, organized grab ass is what I've been calling it for years. I worked with some baseball players, dude. Like, the fact that you can show up and do your job drunk. Like, David Wells was my neighbor in Tampa, and dude, the fact that he could throw up and fucking throw heat at 100 hammered, like, I don't know if I can call that a sport.
Also, to
I would disagree.
You think it's more of a sport if you could show up hammered and do it?
There's athletes that play baseball, but it's not an athletic.
Yes.
Endeavor. Yeah. Big baseball guy here, though. But to speak to lacrosse, you can score within 4 seconds off of a faceoff. It's like a bing bang boom, and then the shots go faster than 100 miles an hour. And so where a baseball crowd oohs and ahs if a baseball player almost gets hit and gets out of the way, there's the responsibility of the goalie or any defenseman in front of a shot to eat it. So you have to get hit by the lacrosse ball to then prevent a goal, and it's going 100 miles an hour. It doesn't feel good. So
it's the fastest,
America's original pastime. ahead of baseball. It was invented by the Native Americans. But yes, and fastest growing. The concussions are pulling a lot of youth away from football, mm-hmm. and lacrosse is there to catch all those kids that are interested in a fun, heavily skill related.
Is there any head injuries or anything in lacrosse?
Well, it depends on how you play. So if you're a football player from Texas that then makes his way to the East Coast and uses your head as a weapon, more or less. But for the most part, it's a very finesse game. Yeah. And if you are fast, they will find a place for you on the field.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I was a big fan of Paul Rabil. Like, I used to watch a lot of lacrosse because I was like, this guy Paul Rabil is like, I mean, he's unbelievable. Like, he's doing things that I hadn't seen. And just, like, I really liked his approach to the sport.
And for our audience, Les, I'm sorry to interrupt. Paul Rabil, he went to DeMatha High School, D.C. area, Johns Hopkins University, which is a Division I lacrosse powerhouse, and then initiated and started the Premier Lacrosse League. So the professional league as we know it.
After leaving the MLL and then going, like, he was a player in a league and then decided to start his own league and then play in it. And I'm like, that's gangster. So just like that alone, I'm like, all right, I'm watching this thing. So I'm watching the sport, and I love the tactical side of sports, where in football, it's like, watching how the offense is organized, and in soccer, I like to see how they develop, like, different plays and different sets off different things. And lacrosse is like that times 100, because you have circular motions, you have, like, different plays, different players on offense and defense, like, different numbers. Like, it was insane. So, and then I'm looking at, like, the athleticism of it. I'm watching the midfielders cross midfield and hit super high speeds and then break and then change directions. And I'm watching the attackers, like, change direction really fast, forward, back. So I'm like, all right, look, this is a sport I want to start working with. So I grabbed some high school kids. They ended up going on to play at Stanford and Cal, a couple other places, and just started developing them, and they became monsters. So this was like a long time coming to get into sport. So essentially what we're helping athletes do in the PLL Academy is help them learn the skills of accelerating and decelerating and how to hit high speeds. But a lot of it's focused on how they can use speed as a skill in their game and how they can differentiate themselves. And, like, just kind of how we were talking, like, a lot of people think speed is something you're either born with or you're not. So a lot of kids grow up and they're like, hey, I'm not fast, I'm going to play this position. But it's like, okay, well, you're not fast now, but you could develop into whatever position you want to play if you're 9 years old, 10 years old. Like, stop. You know what I'm saying? Like, these kids go to these coaches that say, hey, you're not fast and you're fast, so this is your whole life path. It's like, bro, you're 10. Like, you could choose to be fast. Like, you can choose. Now, you're not going to be Usain Bolt fast, but you might be a really good accelerator, or you might be really good at running high speed. So there's different places for you if you develop that skill. So that's the opportunity we're looking to give these athletes.
I mean, it happened to me. I was pretty fast when I was younger, and then I grew a whole bunch, and I wasn't fast. And it was fucking like, it really sucked, because I remember I grew a bunch in, like, I think it was around 7th and 8th grade. And I was super fast in 6th. And then we had to do, every Friday we had a timed run. And I fucking went from getting an A on my run at a run time to getting like a C or a D. And I was so mortified that I had to go home and tell my mom that I was getting a bad grade in PE, that I asked to do, like, I've told you a story, like, do extra runs. And I remember, like, telling the teacher, I'm like, is there something extra I can do? She's like, well, we have makeup runs. I'll just give you more points if you show up and run. And I was like, okay. So I had to lie to my mom. I'm like, hey, I'm working, or I'm
got detention.
I got class. Like, I got to study after he picked me up late. And then I would just run the extra runs, because I was so, but I've always said, dude, shame is a powerful fucking motivator. And then all of a sudden I showed up. By the time I got to high school, like, I remember I went out and I played high school football or my freshman year. And then my sophomore year, I was like, hey, I want to run the hurdles. And I just knew, like, watching Edwin Moses run the 110 hurdles, like, fucking incredible. I loved watching hurdlers. Edwin Moses also ran the 400, didn't he? Like, the longer one? I can't remember if he ran both. But I just remember watching it, and I, like, something I always wanted to do. And so I was able to go out and run hurdles. And they were like, hey, if you throw the shot with us, we'll let you run the hurdles. And I was like, sweet. So I went out and threw the shot, and then I got to train with the sprinters. And all of a sudden, I was fucking fast again. And it was because all of a sudden we were doing the drills and sprinting.
Golden 400 hurdles.
Yeah, he ran the 400. He didn't run the 100, though. Did he?
Well, he just has the gold
in the 400. So, but yeah, I mean, it happened by training and by going out and running the hurdles. And like, and all of a sudden, as I got bigger and I was 250 pounds, I could still run the hurdles and was still fast. And so I think and it was a lot more beneficial for me to go out and run track and do that training than it was to do the football training, which our standard conditioning workout was 16 220s. So we'd run a 220.
Damn.
So it was basically like we had a 440 track, right? Tell you how old it is. We'd walk a 220, run a 220, and we'd end up running 16. So it was basically, what's that, fucking 16 220s. I mean, that's 4 miles of just sprinting. I mean, it's like the most ridiculous shit you've ever seen. And we did that in football every Wednesday. That was our speed workout.
Yeah.
And then, so I was like, dude, I felt like I just got slower. And then I just went out and ran high school track and it was fucking the best thing. And then my football coach was mad at me and I'm not a good team player and you think you're better than us and typical bullshit. And I'm like, well, dude, I was smart enough at 16 years old to get the fuck away from this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it hasn't changed too much. And like, that's where I'm saying when it comes to speed is that people don't really understand what that word means. It's maximal. And you can't do anything maximal for a huge volume. It's got to be controlled. It's got to have the right rest. But yeah, that makes sense to go do all that volume and then get back into a setting where the intention is to run fast, not to run volume. Yeah.
Les, I got a question on athleticism development. And you have the opportunity to work with a lot of professionals. So I'm curious, man, early specialization, based off the professionals you're working with, has that helped them? Or what do you see any problems with it? What do you encourage for your younger athletes to do?
Well, when I talk to any of my NFL guys, not one of them ever specialized in the sport until college. Not one. Like, I might have had, well, that's not entirely true. I think Joe Burrow might have dropped basketball his senior year. But, like, I mean, these guys did everything, you know, baseball, basketball, football. I don't see early specialization as anything but a good business model for people that are running business models.
Amen.
Because they want to, I mean, if I'm a businessman, shit, like, let's go. I'm soccer 12 months a year.
Yeah.
Camps, winter camps.
It's, like, it's the club team model, dude. They just fucking, they're bilking these kids. I mean, literally Chris and I had this exec today or yesterday, they're leaving so much athleticism on the table. I mean, the amount of dudes that I played with, like I played with two guys that were, we know Nick Hardwick wrestled and went out, and I think it was like last year, went to go play for Purdue. I played with Steve Neal, who wrestled in I think he might have wrestled in the Olympics, never played football, walked on and played like a decade with the Patriots. And the amount of guys, Tony Gonzalez, never really liked football. He was a way better basketball player. He just knew that he had a better chance to go play in the NFL as a 6'4" tight end. I mean, so it drives me crazy that they're forcing kids into this specialization because it makes them so one-dimensional. I didn't even play high school or I didn't even play football until I went to high school, and I thought the sport was stupid until all of a sudden I started getting all these scholarship offers, you know? So
there's too much of that. It's a business model. They're trying to keep the money in-house. But also, you need to develop other skills. Like, you become a better football player if you have skill sets from basketball. Like, especially think about a receiver, like jumping or like body position or body angle or being able to get open. Like, all those skills, like, those things transfer. Like, I remember talking to we got a guy staying on our couch because he just got released from a team. He won't get picked up until next Tuesday. So he's like, let's go play basketball. And I'm like, all right, let's go. Like, I could probably beat this guy. And he was like, so good. I swear this dude, he's an NFL receiver. I swear he could have played in the NBA, just like how bad he's beating me. And I was like, all right, tell me your story. He's like, look, when I was younger, I learned releases by learning like the crossover in basketball. Like, I switched the skill over. And it's like, you take even a sport like baseball, where, it might not be the most exciting thing, but there's aspects of the patient side in baseball, or being able to maximally do something and then wait around for a while, but stay mentally in tune. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you can't learn that just by playing your sport, essentially. I think about, like, my daughter, like, she's two. My pathway for her is dance. Like, she's going to dance. And then when she gets to the point where she's starting to talk back to me, we're going to do martial arts. And then when she wants to go put, have fun and be outside, we're going to do soccer. And I'm going to just stack these sports and these skills. But yeah, it's sad because a lot of the people that are running these clubs have no idea that 100 competitions a year is not good for a 14-year-old soccer girl. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not good.
Swimming for your daughter. So swimming and then also gymnastics.
Yep.
So like when we
look, swimming, gymnastics.
Yeah. So when we looked at all the Russian training manuals, when they were talking about like developing athletes, like they put the kids in dance was the first one because it taught them rhythm. Swimming was different orientations, you know, like different atmosphere, kind of like within the water, gliding, completely different. Gymnastics in terms of orientation, developing the inner ear. I mean, so like, yeah, I mean, like you're, you know, dance for rhythm, you know, swimming, gymnastics, and then putting them into some form of sport. Like I didn't learn how to cut a dude off or how to pass protect, playing football. I learned it boxing, how to cut a dude off in the ring, play 2/3 inside out, first meaningful touch. I mean, all the shit that I learned within the boxing ring and fighting, that was more beneficial for me, learning to play offensive line. When I went out there, I was like, shit, this is like fighting against dudes that don't know how to use their hands or how to fight. You know, I mean, now the one regret I was telling Chris, I wish I had wrestled in high school. I started getting all these scholarship offers and I was too nervous about like losing weight. You remember that whole thing where you're like, oh, you're going to lose weight. You're, you know, never going to be able to put it back on. And I didn't go wrestle. And now I wish I had, because when all of a sudden I started playing with those wrestlers like Steve Neal and those guys, they had such incredible balance and their ability to like absorb and reload and redirect and move within space. I was like, fuck, like I learned it in a different way. These guys, I wish I'd had that skill as well. You know, because football isn't like, it's such an unnatural sport in terms of like what's demanded of you. But what's wild is the best football players I was ever around were really good at other things that actually contributed to football.
Do you, Les, 100%. Do you take the dance moves that your daughter's class does and teach them to like Hutchinson and your defensive lineman?
He has that on his own. Hutch has that on his own.
Well, defensive linemen aren't very smart, so you got to like, you know, use Crayolas and draw it out for him usually.
I don't know. He went to Michigan.
These dudes are.
So did Runyon.
Geniuses now.
So did Runyon, and Runyon's a rocket scientist, even though he was a congressman. So.
Okay.
Steve Everett was our center. Yeah.
Next up, man, in the business of battling bullshit. I love that you're on a mission to educate coaches and see where speed can fit into the practices and not take away from the speed that they work so hard to develop in the off season. What are some big things that coaches are missing, even speed coaches, that they're missing in training, in programming, that you see that are taking away from athletes' performance? Because that's why we're really here. Right, to empower athletes.
How much time you got?
30 minutes.
I could go forever. All right, so here's the main thing. Just how we talked about early specialization for sports, there's specialization in speed as well. So what is specialization to me is technique. So what most people think is speed is like get really good at technique. So let's watch Usain Bolt and then let's go out and let's try to mimic that. So the biggest issue with that is that different limb lengths are going to produce different styles of running. So Usain Bolt, he can produce a longer ground contact time. His foot can stay longer on the ground because his leg is 3 times my leg. So he's got a longer distance that he's covering. He's got a longer contact distance, right? Or he's going to have a bigger like thigh lift. It's going to look like a certain way. But like not everybody's going to have that. So trying to fit a technical model to every kid that's exactly the same is the biggest pet peeve that I have. And in fact, I would say if I'm a coach and I'm starting out and I'm working with youth athletes, the first thing that I should get really good at is understanding periodization, and not just periodization like strength only, like periodization as a philosophy, like understanding when and where and how to, what's the GPP phase, like what are special exercises, like whatever you look at. I don't care if you look at Bonnerchuk, I don't care if you look at Charlie Francis, I don't care. Like, learn some style of periodization and research and go ask coaches, like, hey, coach, like, what is your philosophy? So starting there and then understanding what volume, intensity, and density is. So how much work do we have to do to get this job done? How fast is that work needed to be? And then how many breaks should we be taking and how long should those breaks take? Like, understand that. And then from there, if you can do those two things well, where you're able to schedule out times where you'll accelerate, times where you'll hit high speed, times where you'll do changes of direction. If you do that alone, you're basically a professional, you're Olympic level coach. Now, the next phase of that is like, now, if you get to the point where you've seen enough runs that you can start to understand different types of runners based around how they're built, then you could start giving advice on, hey, this is how I would best recommend doing speed training. Oh, can you guys hear me?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I muted. Yeah, so this is how I'd best recommend implementing your training. And from there, using drills as your coaching. Most of the time when I go to like other coaches' speed sessions, it's the kid running and the coach is screaming at them while they're running full speed. Lift your knees, do this, do that. Like, you come to our speed sessions, I've had coaches say, you didn't say anything. I'm like, yeah, I know, it was a great session, right? Like, you know what I mean? That's the goal. If I could say nothing, that's the goal. But I do that over time by putting you through different progressions of different drills, of different things to get to that final.
Well, you're also not a cheerleader. I always tell our athletes, if we're not saying anything, you're doing it right. Like, I'll yell at you if it's fucked up or if some sit. And so, like, I think people are like, well, you didn't say anything. I'm like, well, it looked pretty good. If it sucked, you would have heard about it. I'm not a fucking cheerleader.
Yeah. No, facts. Facts. But most coaches, like, I shouldn't say most coaches. That's, like, really aggressive. I should say there's a lot of coaches entering in the industry for other reasons. And those reasons are to get fame, to get a blue check, to get money. But like, coaching is probably the most selfish thing you can do. And obviously there's money involved in it because you got to get a living. But I think if the better coach you are, the more selfless of a person and the more giving you are. Typically, like, all the coaches I know at the highest level are very like giving and very good humans. But what happens is like, you get a lot of fluff in the beginning part because people are entering because they want to get on, you know, they want to get that blue check. They want to get some money and it's a hustle. But like, you're dealing with lives and you're dealing with like, I mean, all of us remember our coaches when we were 13, 14 years old. I couldn't tell you some of my teachers' names, but I remember my coaches. Yeah. You know, you have the biggest influence in some of these kids' lives. So like, I don't ever curse in podcasts, but if your goal is to get rich and famous, stay the fuck out of my industry. Like, I don't want people like that because you're dealing with humans. You're dealing with people that really need you. So if your intentions aren't there, then it's not good. So that's the biggest thing I see. Now, there are a lot of good coaches getting into the industry, but I really, you know, it's a huge point that I've like never made on a podcast before, that like, there's so much of that BS going on.
Yeah. And now you can pay for a blue check. So stay the fuck out of our industry.
Oh, blue check. I was thinking like a physical check, like a blue, I would fucking social media. I would.
Big checks. Why can't I get one of those?
Yeah. I just want a big check. Happy Gilmore. I want it blue, you know, but yeah, no, I was like, yeah, fucking, of course everybody wants a check. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute, blue check. Oh, fuck that. No, but I mean, it's, yeah, dude, I'm with you, dude. Like, you know, we constantly run into coaches and, you know, people. And I think people are really good at just finding somebody who's like information or their success and then parroting it. Like, there's very few original thinkers. And I think when you do meet people that are original thinkers that are doing something new and attacking it in a different way, like, those are industry leaders. And I mean, we run into people that are just real good at parroting somebody else's content.
Yeah, 100%. And then it breaks down at a certain point. It's like, it really comes down to this. It's like, if your intention is to grow as a coach, you're going to continuously read and study and go all this. But if your intention is to make money, you're going to figure out ways to do that. It's hard to do both when you're first starting, which is why internships are important, which is why growing under a coach is important. So you can go through those phases of all the phases you would, you know, that would say like the bad phase of trying to get fame, all this stuff. But you're going through that being mentored by somebody. Like, coaches are jumping in the industry after completing a degree and going straight to like, I'm going to coach at this team and do all this. I'm like, dude, you gotta learn and understand what this industry is really about and what your actual purpose is here. And then you can start to look at, how do I make that a business model? You know?
Yeah. Whether it's sport with football coaches, especially here in Texas, where they're guarding their program, whether their it's fiefdoms. Strength or their offense, whatever, they guard it. And we see the same thing in the performance industry. They're guarding it. And what you've done a good job on this podcast, sharing the mentors of people and referencing other folks, you've also done a good job. And I've had the opportunity to work through your online education. So giving away your information. You think you can do this better than me? here's all everything that I've learned in my experience, and I want you to empower athletes. So speak to that online education that you've built and the aim and you're hoping to accomplish by putting all your information out there.
Yeah, no, like my goal is to help athletes, and the best vehicle to help athletes is to help the people that are coaching them. So like if I were to look at the industry 10 years ago, there was a lot more, this is mine, don't share, don't talk about it. And it's tough because like as a coach, had I not had Dan Paff or Jonas or Stu, or all these people like pour into me, I probably would have been like on the other side of coaching where it was just like a strictly business model where it's just, here's how I make money and this is, I go home. You know, so I think what I wanted to do was provide resources for coaches that they could deliver to athletes. Like we did a lot of direct to athlete stuff, but I found it difficult because I found it really hard for athletes to stay engaged without somebody walking them through it because it's a kind of a new skill in some ways. So I really switched and pivoted towards coaches and building communities because when I was younger, sports saved my life. And had I not had a coach, had I not had some of the experience I had with coaches, I could have been in a completely different lifestyle at this point. So it's like, what is a bigger goal? And obviously we found a way to like make it a business model. We still struggle with that, but as long as the mission is to help more people, I felt really confident about putting every single thing that I do out there. And even to be critiqued, they're made better. Like sometimes I give information out and then somebody does it way better than I could have ever done it. And I'm like, okay, can you teach me that? You know, it's like helped me grow as a coach. And it's built like this online community where coaches are sharing more. Coaches are talking more. There's less like beef. Like people are going to conferences. People are seeing the importance of the education as a coach. And, you know, we all need guidance in this thing. Like I still have mentors and guiders, like people that guide me even more so now than I did in the beginning. So I think it's a necessary thing for our industry.
Yeah, we aim to empower performance and create hammers that can make an impact as coaches. So similar online vein, and then get coaches to travel out to us to go through it and be critiqued. So part of our certification process is you fly out to Austin and educate and teach and converse with us, and then we provide feedback to help you garner and improve your professionalism in this industry. So helping to develop coaches, not only so they can parrot, so they don't parrot information.
No.
They understand it and can deliver it to the parent, the sport coach, or the athlete in a way that they can understand it.
Well, I mean, we see it. I mean, dude, I'm sure you see it within the strength game where you hear people like saying stuff and you're like, oh yeah, no, I read that book too. I mean, I hear it constantly. I mean, especially with, who's the strength coach? Franz Bosch.
Oh
my God.
I don't know if you had the opportunity to explore some of his books, Les, but it's awesome.
Of course,
it's great.
I come from the Charlie Francis school and had the opportunity to work with Charlie many years ago. When I ruptured my patellar tendon, he actually gave me EMS protocols that helped me get back. And we talked a bunch about training. Yeah. So Charlie was a big influence. And, you know, Franz Bosch, incredible stuff. But it's wild, like where I hear, you know, it's like, you know, the only analogy I can give it is like carb cycling. You know, Mauro De Pasquale is the guy that invented that, and Mauro did my diet, and I'll hear people still recycling his shit and just being like, oh, I come up with this. And you're like, yeah, man, it's 20 years ago, dude, at least. Pay.
But, John, you only got 60 seconds on TikTok. No time to give credit.
Yeah, to give context. No, but it's I always appreciate where people are like, I mean, you've done an excellent job here being like, you know, these are the mentors. I wouldn't be here without these people. This is where the information, which I think we've also done a good job of, where it's like, fuck, man, I didn't invent any of this stuff. We just found a different way to kind of talk about it and arrange it.
Yeah, no, there's nothing new in the industry. I'm sorry. Like, you know, like I saw something on like foot strength and all that, and people are like, oh, this is new. And the article was great. It's not new. Like, Charlie was talking about that. And before Charlie, Ralph Mann and all those, like, everybody's been talking. It's just different. Information is disseminated through culture. And when you can match up information and culture, you get retention. And like sometimes the stuff is coming through TikTok now and you're like, oh, that's BS. But people can actually digest it, whether they, you know, came up with it or not. And like people are really good at explaining things now. I have to say, influencers, for all the things that I don't like about them. They can take a whole subject and explain it in 30 seconds. Like, that's a skill set that we need. And like, it leads to another point, like real quick, is like, coaches should study project management. They should study other fields. Like, they could study, like, what is a graphic designer? How do they build their hours? Like, because like our coaching fields, like, we grow up and we go through school and you do all the strength stuff and you know, get into your niche, and that's all you've pretty much been in that category for a while. But there's so much to learn from outside categories, like in marketing, business, project management. So some of that is like, once you learn those things, then you could take whatever product, whatever you were regurgitating, and you could shape it up in a better way where people can grasp it and understand it.
You know? Yeah. What I'm curious what you studied at school while you were there.
I studied film.
Film.
I was studying to become an editor.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, you know what? So this is crazy. This is like, I was just talking about this yesterday. So when I was in high school, we had Facebook and all that. That just came out as a senior. But when I was a senior in college, Instagram was coming out. So in film class, we were talking about Instagram in film class and the potential and what we should do now on Instagram. And like, I mean, things like when I was starting out, like we spent hours and hours on a computer learning shortcuts for editing. Well, that became my superpower for coding because I got really familiar. I was super helpful. I had a ton of computer time. And like, I was computer literate. And then Instagram, like, I started posting in 2011, you know, like, as soon as it came out, I'm sitting with my film teacher and like, yo, what kind of, how do I do graphic design now? How do I do this thing? Like, the first part of my career until I had a marketing director, I did every single thing. And my film career was super helpful because it's also storytelling. Mm-hmm. So most of my classes were on how do you tell a story? So how do you tell a story through editing? How do you tell a story through shooting? How do you tell a story through producing? And you would have to go in these different roles and tell stories. Well, when you look at sports, it's like you have your sports scientist, you have a general manager, you have your sport coach, you have your strength coach. You're telling stories from different perspectives, but the goal is still the same thing. You still want to win a game, get to a championship, get a Super Bowl. But you have to learn those perspectives in order to have a full picture. I couldn't be a good editor unless I knew filming. Couldn't do filming unless I knew producing. So they make you learn everything. Now, our field is very siloed. So strength and conditioning is S&C. Speed is speed. You know, like, nutrition is nutrition. You know, sports science is sports science. But nobody speaks a common language because they hadn't been in those roles. You know what I mean? So I didn't become a good speed coach until I was working as a strength coach with the U.S. Olympic teams and learning. I don't know shit about periodization. I have to study it. I have to study it because I can't just keep doing workouts. You know, I have to learn planning. I have to learn tactical periodization. I have to learn all these things that I didn't have the skill sets for, and continue to look at myself and be like, I need to get better here. I need to get better here. So yeah, interesting.
Very interesting. I imagine very helpful, especially when you're communicating to your athletes, because they are writing their own story, and you can help bring that whole scale, the whole project into perspective, because not only do they have to train with you, they also have to recover. They also have to understand their body, their nutrition, their recovery. They got to learn the offense, defense, etc., and they got to look out for themselves, you know, dealing with, you know, contracts and unruly fans and all those stresses that come with being a professional athlete. But that's awesome, man. I appreciate the
well. I mean, he lives in Philly. He knows all about unruly fans.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, Philly is the best fan.
Oh yeah. No, I, dude, yeah. The best and most unruly. Other than having played with Philly was awesome, but going and playing in Oakland against the Raiders when I was with the Chiefs and into that fucking cesspool that is the black hole. Like, I fucking hate the Raiders and the Raiders. And I grew up a Raiders fan. I grew up in LA and playing like, and going into Oakland. And I mean, I went to Berkeley too, and going in and playing in that, like the people, I just am like, oh God, the lowest level life forms are people that comment on YouTube videos and Raiders fans that go to the games.
What about Raiders fans that comment on YouTube videos?
The lowest level life forms on the planet. Like, fuck. Like, I remember there was a grandmother, grandkid, and like, I'd like it'd be her son. And like, they were like, the kid, like the grandma was holding the kid. The kid had to be like 3 or 4. He's just like double fucking middle fingers. And the grandmother pulled her pants down and beat us. And then the kid, and then the son was there with like a sign that was like, fuck you. So like, the son had a fuck you sign. The 3-year-old was given double birds. And then the grandma fucking pulled her ass out and beat us. And I'm like, some classy people we got here, Oakland. I mean, like the shit you would see, like, you know, like the kids would come up behind the bench and you turn around. And it was just like some 6-year-old kid motherfucking you like you never heard. And you're like, holy shit. My 6-year-old kid was talking like that, I'd fucking smash him. But it's Raiders fans, different breed, different breed. The Philly fans just want to get drunk and fight everybody, which I appreciate. But yeah, yeah, the fucking Raiders fans or something else.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice.
Well, cool, man. Les, I appreciate your time, dude, and on point with this online education. Where can people learn more and follow you on social and check out your website?
Yeah, so easy website, my name, lesspellman.com. Social, Les7Spellman, Instagram and Twitter. Yeah, I talk a lot of trash on there, so just hop on and join the conversations.
Yeah, what do you talk trash about? What do you talk about trash about, or what are you talking trash on about training?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, it could be anybody the Eagles are playing, or it could be training, it could be whatever. Okay. But yeah, we have fun on there, so hop on.
All right, I like it.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining us on Power Athlete Radio.
Bye.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.